For CertSecurity.com, I'm Rob Westervelt. You're listening to Security Wire Weekly for May 28th, 2008. In this edition, we'll talk with Tim Callen of VeriSign about the latest on a vulnerability affecting encryption key pairs generated with specific Debian Linux versions. Callen explains how the vendor is responding by offering to reissue SSL certificates for free. We'll also address VeriSign's extended validation certificate business. Some researchers are saying cross-site scripting vulnerabilities are putting a blemish on the extended validation SSL certificate. And finally, Paul Wood is joining us to talk about the latest on phishing attacks. Paul says some fishers are going green. Up next, my interview with VeriSign, but first this message.
When it comes to analyzing a network, protecting enterprise data, or fighting malware, you can plop down thousands of dollars for a commercial product, or you can get tons of great functionality from a free tool. Let CertSecurity.com show you how some of the industry's best free and open source tools work in our exclusive screencast series. Each month, one of CertSecurity.com's best experts will offer a step-by-step video presentation showing you how to use the most powerful tools and software, including Nessus, Snort, UTM, and so much more. And it's all free. Don't wait. Watch and learn today. Visit searchsecurity.com/screencast. That's searchsecurity.com/screencast.
And we're back. Tim Callen is a product manager for VeriSign's SSL business unit. The unit has been busy in recent weeks defending its SSL business by taking steps to protect customers affected by an encryption key flaw in some Debian Linux versions. The vendor reached out to all its customers and offered to reissue certificates for free. The vendor's extended validation SSL certificate program is also under fire from some security experts. Those experts say the program is being blemished by a wave of attacks targeting SQL injection vulnerabilities on some websites. They're pointing to a recent cross-site scripting vulnerability at the online payment service PayPal, which could allow malicious code injection despite the site using an extended validation SSL certificate. Here's what Tim had to say.
Forensics have revealed that approximately 18 months ago, a bug was introduced, was accidentally introduced into the Debian random number generation function. And one of the consequences of that, was that the random numbers weren't very random. And one of the consequences of that, of course, is since random number generation is the cornerstone to creating key pairs that are not easily guessable in the OpenSSL interface, that as a consequence, the key pairs that were generated on this operating system or its derivatives are very easily crackable because the potential key space becomes very, very small. Now, as a consequence of that, now none of this was known. At least none of this was known by the White Hats for about a year and a half. And if any of the Black Hats knew about it, they weren't saying anything. And I don't know how to evaluate whether or not they did. They probably didn't because it's a fairly obscure bug to discover. But once it was, once this did become clear by a security researcher, obviously at that point, he notified the press notified the world, and at that point you have to pretty much assume that the Black Hats are getting the news and are going to be prepared to take advantage of this problem if it's not immediately plugged up. So that information came to us, gosh, I guess at this point it was around Tuesday or Wednesday of the week before last. I could go back and look it up, but it was around there. And so, we heard about the story right when it broke. And so what we did immediately was we mobilized a series of activities, the first of which, of course, was to go ensure that all of our own certificates were fine. So if you go to verisign.com, the SSL certificates there are not compromised. Furthermore, our own routes and intermediates that we offer for the certs that we make available to the public also are not compromised in any way on any of our brand. And that was the single thing that had to be accomplished right away. Once that was accomplished, then the question was, what should we do about it? And clearly the answer was to do everything we could to find the subset of users or of sites who would have had one of these compromised key pairs and do everything you can to get them to replace them with a set of key pairs that are not compromised. So we came up with a series of activities in order to do that. We've actually reached out to our entire customer base in one form or another, and that's a pretty big task. We have over a million active certificates. And we literally have communicated with the entire customer base. We also communicated with the press in more public kind of forums in order to the press too could help get out the word. And then the big thing we did was ordinarily revocation and replacement of certificates carries a pretty small fee with it, but enough of a fee to make sure people really want it. Mm-hmm. Rather than something that they're doing just on a whim. And we have temporarily suspended that. So between now and June 30th, anybody can revoke and replace their certificates for free.
How complex is it? How complex mm-hmm. is it to actually revoke and replace any SSL? Is it difficult to do that, or?
For us, it's very easy because all of the software is in place and the mechanisms are in place. So literally, if you have a VeriSign certificate, you can go to the VeriSign website and click on a link there that says existing customers, and then you can use revoke and replace functionality that is built right into the website that is quite straightforward and near instant. So somebody can go, they can revoke their cert, they can get the new one all in a matter of seconds. And it's very easy, it's very straightforward, it's really something that anybody who has the know-how to handle certificates can do. And it's very robust. That basic functionality has been running for more than a decade, and there are no indicators that there's anything wrong with it. So in that regard, it's a very good system for people to use.
Has VeriSign ever had to do this before? Or?
What we've never seen is any flaw detected that would indicate that the potential number of certificates that are out there right now might not be reliable, as we've seen today. In that regard, this is unprecedented. And therefore, the other thing that is unprecedented is we've never been in a situation before where we really had to communicate to the world of SSL users at large for something like this. So that also has been a new event for us and something that we really had to mobilize on to act on very quickly.
I want to talk just a little bit about some of the security with EVSSL, in that it does not extend to testing the site for XSS flaws, the cross-site scripting attacks. Users technically could be easily fooled. We had this issue with PayPal. Their site was at one time allowed malicious code injection despite the site using the EVSSL certificate. Does this put VeriSign sort of in a bad place, because now you're giving a seal of approval of a site, and there are many sites out there that are vulnerable to these cross-site scripting flaws?
I think it's important. I think that's a good question. I'm glad that we're talking about it. I think it's important that people understand what an EVSSL certificate is and is not doing. And what the EVSSL certificate is doing is it is ensuring you that you are doing business with the site that you think you're doing business with. And that is a very, very important thing, right? So while an obscure cross-site scripting attack was found by a researcher that he could perform on PayPal, something that happens tens of millions of times a day is that spam emails that are phishing attacks go to ordinary PayPal users and try to trick PayPal people into giving up their account information.
Sure.
So we really need to keep these things in perspective.
We keep them in perspective, but the question is grandma surfing the web really going to be, is going to really understand that when she goes to this site and she sees this beautiful green bar her that she could put her information in?
And so here's my point. My point is that grandma surfing the web is highly unlikely to be the victim of a cross-site scripting attack anyway. It's not an attack vector that is that common in the world. Like people really being victimized by cross-site scripting, genuinely being victimized by cross-site scripting, is a pretty minor occurrence, as opposed to people genuinely being victimized by phishing or genuinely being victimized by malware attacks that depend on a site pretending to be something that it's not. And in that regard, the real attack vectors that are really affecting the world in a significant way are greatly mitigated by the presence of extended validation SSL.
Up next, Paul Wood, a senior analyst at Message Labs, discusses what the labs has intercepted, which is a phishing scam that's taking advantage of Missouri-based central bank's new initiative to go green. It's the first of its kind, and Paul Wood said that it's a different angle to dupe victims rather than the more obvious your account is locked theme, making it more difficult to spot it as a fish. Paul talks about this fish and other phishing emails that have been discovered of late in this interview. What is this latest Go Green campaign by some of the fishers? They're targeting the Missouri-based central bank?
That's correct. And I think initially it seemed to be an interesting kind of spin on the traditional sort of phishing techniques that we're used to, where you see a typical security alert type email. And in this case, they seem to have foregone that approach, favoring, imitating a recent campaign that this bank in particular has been running for some time. So if you were a customer of the central bank in Missouri, then you may be encouraged to sign up for something that they call e-statements, so that you opt out of receiving your paper statements. And a number of businesses are perhaps taking that approach as well to perhaps reduce their carbon footprint in many ways. So what's happened in this case is that the fishers have cottoned onto that opportunity to encourage people to actually, in this case, register for this free service. So when you click on the link, you're taken to a site that looks like the central bank site, but is in fact a phishing site.
To describe the phishing email, it looks like it came from central bank, and it's got a link in it so people can register. So there's a link for people to click. And this goes back to why do you think banks are continuing to send out links to customers? I mean, that's still happening.
That's a very good question. I think it's a problem that not only banks have to consider, but also a number of businesses who are sending out emails, marketing communications, emails that contain links. So if you're following best practice, all the current kind of advice would say don't click on a link in an email. And of course, people are still sending out links, whether it's a bank or any other kind of business for that matter. I think a lot of banks have suffered as the phishing phenomenon has really made it almost impossible for them to send legitimate messages to their customers for fear of them believing that it's a potential scam.
From a security perspective, the links don't necessarily go back to the recipient's account. Some banks are using two-factor authentication, but what is the problem with two-factor authentication, Paul? I guess they give rise to man-in-the-middle phishing sites?
Well, certainly, as we've, I think if we go back perhaps a couple of years now, when two-factor authentication was really beginning to be talked about in a big way in terms of an anti-phishing technology, what we already started to see then is a few phishing attacks aimed at organizations that were experimenting or deploying in relatively small numbers, two-factor authentication techniques. So using, as you mentioned, man-in-the-middle type attacks, just proving that they were just waiting for this technology to take a foothold, and then they'd have to switch their phishing attacks. So because not everyone's gone down the two-factor route, they don't need to look at taking that approach. They're still using the sort of traditional phishing type emails with links and dressing up those links in many different ways. So in some cases we've seen links that have a HTTPS connection. So when you actually click on it, you will be presented with a bank's phishing site or a phishing site of the bank, but it will have a padlock. And of course that's something that people are encouraged to look for as well. But I think one of the challenges with two-factor authentication is that it's quite expensive to roll out. And I think in terms of agreeing a standard across the industry, it makes it very difficult. So if you've got multiple accounts or perhaps accounts in different organizations that use different techniques, you may have a pocket full of different key fobs. And some standards would suggest that you use your bank card in a device and then present your PIN number. And then the device would present a code that you then type into the website. It becomes more and more complicated. So as we introduce more and more security into the system, it means it's much more difficult for people to actually use in a simple way, and in some cases can put people off.
To go back for a moment, in January, Message Labs came out with an announcement saying that for the first time this year, phishing emails are outnumbering Trojan email attacks. What's behind that?
Well, one of the approaches that can be taken with phishing, if you're targeting an organization that employs two-factor authentication, is to deploy a Trojan onto the machine or the user's machine. And that Trojan potentially will do nothing if you don't visit that particular website or maybe a list of websites. But if you do, then it can monitor your browser, wait for you to complete the authentication process, even if you have a two-factor device. And once you're in, it will then hijack your session without your knowledge, and then behind the scenes do something like a money transfer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the approaches that's also been developed. So targeted Trojans is certainly a phenomenon, I think, that's been increasing in recent years. When we first noticed this trend back in 2005, we would have intercepted perhaps one or two per week. And in 2005, we would have been scanning perhaps 1.5 billion emails a week, whereas now we're scanning about 2.5 billion every day. And as time has marched on, so if you fast forward to a year, so between 2005 and 2006, that number rose from one or two per week to one or two per day. And then again, a year later, it increased to 10 per day. So if we're looking at targeted Trojans now, we're probably in the region of about 70 or 80 per day.
Okay.
And those are Trojans that are specifically crafted to individuals within organizations, usually for the purposes of intellectual property theft, so not so much in terms of phishing-type attacks. But they will use reconnaissance techniques, so they could use information that they may have gathered about the individual, so their full name, perhaps their job description, the organization they work for, to try and dress up that message to be more convincing. In some cases, they may even spoof the message to originate from somebody that they have a relationship with.
Right. So they're getting more targeted and certainly a little more sophisticated as well.
Yes, it's really about social engineering techniques, and I think one of the factors that's contributed to the bad guys' ability to enhance their social engineering is the widespread use of social networking sites. So sites like Facebook and MySpace that many people have perhaps been used to using in recent months, if not years, but also more professional sites that have been around perhaps a bit longer, like LinkedIn or Plaxo.
Mm-hmm.
And those sites can also give a lot of information away about who you are, where you work, and what relationships you may have with other people.
Well, that ends this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcast by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.